Bonjour, this is Philippe de Rouault from Loré. The farm is called Le Bois, and I work with my wife, Marie-Claire, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 123, or 123. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are in the Loire, the town of Loire, in a southern area of Normandy, as I am showcasing with you yet another stop on the Totally Cider Tour to Normandy. There's going to be more on that chat coming up in just a moment. Hello and welcome to all the regular listeners of Cider Chat. And if you are new to this podcast, well, I hope you are going to enjoy the ride out there in Ciderville, all over the map. That's where we go. And we always begin this podcast by talking a little bit about the news out and about in the world of apples and pears and all things palms. Just this morning, I was conversing via email to someone who was looking for a place, you know, some info on Asturias, because I had been to Asturias back in 2016, that fall, and did a lot of recordings while I was at the International Hall of Gala Affairs, if you will, Gala Apples. They always have an event like every single night in Asturias for cider. And anyway, so hopefully we're going to hook that person up. So what's happening for me is I'm getting a lot of contact from people all over the map. And it is my complete joy to be able to correspond that way. And what I'm finding in turn is that this podcast is becoming like a full-time gig for me. And I love it. I love it so very much, chit-chatting with all the people who contact me from around the world. And I could use the support too. So big tip of the glass to the patrons of Cider Chat. I haven't had anyone sign up to become a patron for a little while now, so that would be really nice to see that happening. You could join at so many different levels, $1 a month, $3, $5, make it $10. And also people who just want to donate, there's these buttons you could push at ciderchat.com. It's all right there. If you're thinking, I would really like to support Rhea and keep this conversation going, check that out at ciderchat.com. I have a message from Jeff. He wrote to me via the Cider Chat Facebook page, and he wrote that he just started listening to this here podcast, and he likes it very much, so we're very happy to hear that. And he also heard me saying that I wish more people would plant peri-pear trees. However, he writes, I've been looking since December, and it seems that everyone sells out pretty early. Now, he's talking about Scion for grafting onto another pear tree. Actually, we were grafting just a couple weeks ago, my friends and I, and this is probably why Mr. Quince is a little like, oh, those pears, is because you graft onto, in this case, a quince rootstock you're putting on your peri-pear signwood. So I'm glad that you mentioned this, Jeff, because right now, if you are in the Northern Hemisphere, this would be the time of year that you would start identifying the trees out there. First thing I would do is get a good photo of a apple blossom or a pear blossom so you could identify that. You don't want to be guessing when you're out in the field. Second thing you want to do is have something to mark the tree. So when you come back in the middle of the summer or next fall looking for that tree to see if it's bearing any fruit, and again the following spring pre-blossom time to get the scion wood, you'll be able to find that tree, especially if you are like myself, where you're like way out in the middle of nowhere. So I have some survey tape. It comes in different bright colors, like bright orange or blue or pink. And I would mark that tree somehow. And then also kind of make a note too. So you want to have a notepad also. So that's three things there. You want to have a visual of what a blossom looks like on a pear or apple tree. Have some way to mark that tree. I recommend like a survey tape. And then 3, have a little notepad so you remember where you were, what road you were on. That is the beginning for your own identification when you don't have any other resource out there in the world. And make sure that you're getting out early enough. Now, a little bit to like note, especially if you live in my part of Ciderville, which is New England, there is an early bloomer out there that is always kind of misleading because, you know, apple blossoms can be white and you'll see a little bit of white and pink in there. But there's another bush or tree, it's called a bush, but it's actually a tree that flowers early, and it's actually the first flowering tree in the landscape. And it's called the shadbush, which I think, you know, is a little side note. It's kind of interesting. The shadbush is so named, as far as I know, because it symbolizes the start of the Andronomous fish run that comes up from the ocean and travels up the rivers in the area. And I'm primarily talking about the Connecticut River, which is a very large river, comes down from way up in New Hampshire, I think almost on the Canadian border, and goes all the way down through New Hampshire, through Vermont, into Massachusetts, Connecticut, and out into Long Island Sound. And one of the fish that comes up the river is the shad. There's also the salmon. They hope the salmon comes back, but it doesn't look so good. Striped bass are now coming up. So I'm not going to give you all my fishing tips because I do love fishing. So if you ever want to go fishing and we're out there in Ciderville, let's do it. But what's really neat is the shadbush that comes out super early. I always use that as my marker, my telltale marker that the shad are starting to run. Some people just look at the water temperature, but I go more from the natural elements and see when that shad bush comes out. And I try to get down on the river then, whether I'm casting from the shore or I go out in a little boat. We bring a little grill. We anchor because you just kind of sit there and they're just like cruising by. And the interesting thing about the shad is that they bite because they're kind of irritated, I guess, and they'll get hooked and they'll just kind of like keep on swimming by your boat. You have to like say, hey, no, come back here. And there's like the roe and the buck, and I really love the roe. So that's a little side note. So tree identification, early spring for really all the trees, right? Like the shad bush and for the apple and pear trees. Make sure that you mark them now for next year. If it's already blossoming, you're not going to really be able to do the grafting at that point. You'll have to wait until next year. And when you do get scion wood, you might be able to go out now and look at it on really any kind of tree. You want to get the most recent growth. So on some of the peri-pear trees that my friends and I just recently grafted and met my backyard a couple weeks ago, we didn't have a large selection to choose from because the pear trees that we were pulling from, they're so tall and so gangly because nobody took care of them for a long time. So a lot of the scion wood was probably like 40 feet up in the air, and I couldn't get up there. So we had smaller pieces of scion wood. But, you know, you could still do that with that little bit of scion wood. And our guest on this week's chat, Philip, he was saying about me like bringing some scion wood back from France. Wouldn't that be fun? No, I didn't. But, you know, that's just another reason to come with me coming up this September on the Totally Cider Tour to Normandy. We're going to be stopping at Philip's farm and drinking his Poré. That's going to be fun. So hang on. We'll be getting to that in just a moment. Oh, this is too funny. Just as I was posting that, in came another message from Jeff saying that he still has about 4 spots in my esplanade that he's trying to get some trees planted. And I asked where he's located. He's in Alpine, Texas, and it's zone 8 for planting. So if you have any trees for this guy who wants to get it going for the palms, send me a message. Rhea@ciderchat.com, and I'll link you up with Jeff. You could also post it on the Cider Chat Facebook page. Anyways, it's all about sharing out there in Ciderville. Good luck, Jeff. Are you headed to Australia in July? Maybe going over to Tasmania? Well, right now the tickets are on sale. It's the early bird tickets for the Hoon Valley Midwinter Fest. This is their wassail scene. It says feasting, cider, fire, and folklore. I'm going to have a link in the show notes. You can check out the little like YouTube clip they have there. Boy, those folks down under, they know how to do it up and party. I'd so love to go to that event. Anyways, the tickets are on sale. Maybe you're going that way. And if you do, do share with us on how you liked it. What's the scene there? We'd love to hear more. Again, there'll be the link to that in the show notes. The Cider Expo is taking place in Normandy, France on July 7th, 8th, and 9th. That's going to be taking place in the capital of Normandy, the city of Caen. That's spelled C-A-E-N. It's just right on the coast, essentially. Beautiful city, like all the cities in France. So check that out. I'll have a link in the show notes to that event. And don't forget, there's three competitions coming up in May. We have May 5th. That's a Boston Homebrew Competition I will be at. That's put on by the Boston Warp Processors. This is kind of a nonprofit homebrew club. They're just doing this for the love of all things fermented. So look in the show links for that. Then there's also the Great Lakes International Cider and Perry Competition happening in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on May 16th through the 19th. Both those events, you have to get in your entries by April 20th. So don't delay on that. And then there's also a competition happening in Herefordshire at the Cider Museum. That's going to be taking place on May 16th. So it'll be like neck to neck with Glencamp and Herefordshire at the same time. Either case, we'll be all drinking and raising our pints of cider and perry. And I, friends, will be on a van ride to the Glencamp scene, and I'll be broadcasting live. I won't be necessarily on this feed, I'm not sure, but it's going to be live. I'm going to be broadcasting live because I am with some crazy-ass cider dudes, and if I don't document that, nobody at home will believe that I actually signed up for a 13-hour voyage with some guys in a van rolling down to Grand Rapids to get to Glencamp. So stay tuned for that. Last fall, when I was preparing for my trip to Normandy, I reached out to the Musée de Perry, which means Museum of Perry, to see if they knew any cider makers in the region who could speak to me about Perry and working particularly with Perry pears. They passed me along to the group of cider makers and said, well, contact any of them. So I wrote to the whole group and I heard back from one. And that particular gentleman is our featured guest this week on Cider Chat. In my research prior to arriving at their farm, I had found out that last year they had opened the farm to musicians and artists to have a weekend festival. That alone piqued my curiosity, not to mention wanting a taste of their Perry. And of course, that's exactly what Philippe did. He shared not only the making of the Perry, but a walkabout. So let's now grab a glass and join this chat with Philippe Duron in Loire, France.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Ria.
Oui, Philippe.
Nice to meet you in person. Can I see where you actually make the
pâté? Yeah.
Right across from the home is the setup here. Oh, the cloth. The cloth, yes.
If you don't wash every week, that starts to transform in vinegar.
Mm-hmm, and that goes to your pâté and cider. Yeah. So this is your wash tank here, right?
This is
just for washing, and these are your racks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How many levels of the rack do you get on your press?
In the machine?
Yes, in the machine.
1 meter, so that's 13.
13.
13, 14
okay.
Level.
Yep.
And you already seen that.
I have a rack and cloth press.
Yeah,
yes,
it's
have.
It's very traditional now.
Absolutely, it works perfect. Yep. Do you keep pâté like you would cider?
What do you mean by keep?
Where before you ferment.
Yeah.
You create that. Chapeau brun.
Naturally, sometimes poire do that, but we can't force it because with the cider we add some pectin and some sort of salt.
So that it keeps.
Yeah.
So yes, I know
you
what you're talking about.
For the
right?
cider, you add two things: pectin at the beginning and one day after. Calcium, some chlorure de calcium, and that reinforce the chapeau brun.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that for the cider. For the poire, you can't do that.
Why not? Why can't you do it?
That doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
But naturally, sometimes you have a small chapeau brun.
So it will naturally just do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but
huh.
not like cider. So
interesting.
What works better? That to transfer from one tank to another tank before the fermentation.
Before the fermentation.
So the yeast fall down,
and
we
you
can
re-
do that.
And how quickly do you transfer from one tank to another after the yeast is on the
bottom? One day after, you can
one
do
One day
that.
After.
Yeah.
So
you can do that every... It depends of your what you need and the time you need, and you can do that twice a week if you want.
So just to get an idea here, you come in with the pears, you press, you put it in the tank, and is it already starting to ferment?
No, it doesn't ferment
that quickly.
We we cool it in this place.
Cool it in this place.
Cooler.
Okay.
That will be for poire. So
okay.
I will transfer it now.
Mm-hmm. So he's showing me the tank that's on the ground right now. It's like a giant milk tank. And that's where they put the juice in. So the juice goes into this tank and then you transfer into...
When I press... By gravity that go in that tank. That's
okay.
A cooler.
Yes.
And then I transfer.
So it's filled with juice right now. Oh, look at that. There's even more tanks back there. We see quite a few tanks. Here I come. The barrels and the bottles. Mm-hmm. That's being transferred out right now. He hooked up the liquid.
The sugar starts to ferment quickly. And if you leave it like that, the next mistake is the vinegar.
Right.
When you let a glass of wine on your window outside, it'll
turn to vinegar.
Vinegar.
Yeah, right.
So that's. I don't know if you can smell it there.
Mm.
No, it's not very warm, but sometimes you can.
So
that's what I had to wash regularly. Now that's a poire.
That's poire.
We pressed yesterday, that's for poire.
So you press and then you let it sit overnight, typically, and then.
Yeah, all the night.
To get the
sediment.
The yeast.
A part of sediment will be already.
Already, wow.
Already. And then.
I love it.
So this is very. I did that yesterday.
Yes, it's filling up. Is that the actual line up there that I see?
Yeah,
it's right there. Okay. So Philippe is out by the tank here getting it all set up. We're looking at it being filled up with the poire that was pressed yesterday into these brown circular tanks.
So I will press this afternoon.
Oh, you press this afternoon, okay.
And then tomorrow I will transfer this one and this one.
Into this one.
And there will be, again, some yeast.
That you'll clean out. Yeah, you just flush.
Because what we wish for poire is different than for the vine. We want a slow fermentation. That's why we cool it. Because for instance, I have a big. I can show you a big tank. 10,000 liters. This one.
Oh yeah.
It's nearly full.
Okay. Yeah.
That's for Calvados.
All right.
But the fermentation will be finished probably in 2 weeks. Because it's warm, we don't care about the sediment, and we leave the yeast working as they can. So it's different for poire or cider. What we want is a slow fermentation.
So
we filter when we can't slow it by the cooler or by changing the tank and have the left sediment. We have to filter.
Right.
We have a filter with Kieselgur. It's some.
A membrane like
no, it's not
paper.
A membrane.
Paper.
No, no. It's we make the filter with a sort of rocks, very like flour.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Like farine flour.
Like a.
For making bread, are you?
Yes. Yeah. Like an actual. Like
rocks.
A powder, almost.
A powder.
But with a little.
We come from not a volcanic rocks, but like clay.
Oh, like a silica or something like that.
Very, very, very thin. And we put that with some poire in a machine, and this powder stays.
Oh, like a fining agent. I see. Yeah, we'd call it like a fining agent that you pour into the liquid and it helps drop and clarify.
No, that's different.
Okay.
We use that for not me, but sometimes for clearing some poire, we stay very not clear, the opposite of clear.
Cloudy?
Cloudy.
Yeah.
Some farmers use this powder. It's made with eggs.
Make with eggs, okay.
And that
drops it down, yeah.
To that
sure.
Catch some molecule and drop.
Drops
now
it
that
down.
Different filter is only to take some yeast and some bacteria, and we make the filter with this powder mixed with poire. We mix 100 liter and some this powder, and that powder stay on a machine like a small tank with some grid with very thin, and the powder can't go. We mix some cellulose with that.
Cellulose.
Like cellulose is wood. It's
where do you do the actual filtering? Right in the tank, right? It's. Oh, okay, cellulose. Yeah,
cellulose.
Yeah, he's holding a cardboard box.
We mix with this powder and poire, and that make the filter. And we force with a pump to go through
that filter.
And
okay.
The yeast and the bacteria stay
right there.
And when the pressure goes up, that means it's full. We have to wash again and start again.
Clean it out. Yeah. Of course.
And we do that. The fermentation is too quick.
So we're walking back over to check out the pump because he's pumping all that puree. Oh, it's not really sucking. It's just kind of, not good. Kind of a dry pump right now. So it's this little tiny floor pump that's pulling it out of this milk tank. Ooh, the sound, it was just dry sucking.
Burning.
Yeah, you don't want that to happen.
Directly across from Philip and Marie-Claire's home is a barn, and one section is where he has his little tasting room, but really he brings the bottles out from that area, and you try the poree or cider in the courtyard. Next to that building is like a shed roof. It's tall enough where you could drive a backhoe into it because he'll lift in these large bins of pears and slowly pour them into a scratcher or a grinder. And then as the pears are being chewed up, they'll go into this large stainless tank that has a corkscrew at the bottom. And that's turning away at the bottom, and it sucks up all the pumice, the ground up pear or apple, whatever he's doing that day. And then he has a pump, like a vacuum like hose, and slowly pours that out into a rack and cloth. And this rack and cloth is really something to see. He does it so neat and so organized. It's a piece of art just to watch that. From there, he's able to use his rack and cloth and press down on the pumice and squeeze out the juice. And that milk tank that I was talking about is in the floor level. It's down. It's like dug into the floor. And it's so ingenious. It's exactly what I had seen in the U.S. with craft brewers here taking milk tanks from farms to brew their beer and store their wort. Well, here is a case of a milk farmer himself taking a old milk tank, or maybe even new milk tank, but I bet it was an old one, digging a hole in the ground and having it below level so that the rack and cloth, as juice is coming out, it just goes right into that milk tank. And then that pump that you were just hearing that was getting a little dry, and I think that was my fault because I was distracting him, that sucks up the juice from the lower level milk tank and into the big circular tanks that I was talking about. And there's a little back room there too, with more tanks and barrels. All this you want to see. There's some great photos in the show notes, and there's going to be a video too. So stay tuned for that. Now let's go back to this chat. So we're looking at the tank and just seeing if the pump is actually working. So, yeah, it's going down slowly. What temperature do you try to have that stay overnight from the pressing?
How many? Between 5 and 10.
5 and 10, okay. Mm. And it's
and then in this room there is a cooler.
There's a cooler in the room.
Let's stay at 13.
Okay, I see that. Yep.
Right.
So you're not actually cooling the tank, and that's what we'd use like in the U.S. for milk.
It's a milk.
It's a milk tank.
Yeah,
yes. But you're not closing it. You're having it be outdoors. You're not actually cooling that tank anymore.
He's working with
It is? Okay, yeah. Okay, because it's open, so I thought maybe not.
Yeah.
You want the natural yeast in the air, no?
Yeah, we don't care about
it. All
it
that,
could be
right.
Better, it could be better if it was closed, but we waste
maybe not.
Some energy to... But we cool it only during 2 hours.
Okay.
Yesterday evening, and I stopped.
Stop.
And that now, because when he... It's cooling. There is a propeller inside.
Yes, inside. Oh, yeah. Sorry, a big winding around like a fan.
If you don't stop, it will be always cloudy.
Right,
so you
right.
Need,
let it
to
settle
be quiet
down.
All night at that sediment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad I got to see this part because this is all very exciting for me to see your process. The puree here is amazing. Just to be able to come and taste the puree in this area, there's just nothing like it in the world. So it's... So unique.
Probably the only place in Europe when there is such a drink. And it's a shame to see all this tree will be destroyed.
And there it was again, that same phrase, that same concern that I heard just last week on episode 122 with Michel D'Argent, that the trees are not as coveted as one might think in the land of abundant pear and cider.
The next generation will continue only if it's economically okay, and you find people who are passionate for this sort of job. And
I have to admit, it crushes my soul to hear someone like Philip talk about his work as being selfless. But for farmers, it's so true. One must be selfless, because they are the ones who must forego that extra sleep in the morning to get up and let out the cows and go on with the day.
Yeah. We cross finger to find, because in 5 years we stop.
You're going to stop in 5 years?
Yeah, 5, 7. Wow. I'm 56, so we want to give the hand to somebody.
Right.
We don't want to die in the work. We work since 35.
Wow. It's a long time.
Yeah.
A long time.
So
yeah.
We have created this place, and when people come here, often they say, oh, that's a very beautiful place here, or you are... But we want to transfer that. We are property of that, but we don't want to sell for the next. We don't want to make them in debt. We want to rent only.
How do you retire from farming if you don't have kids or your kids don't want to come back to the land? And up to recently, there haven't been a lot of options for farmers who were phasing out of that stage of their life and hopefully having a little bit of time in retirement. But thankfully, with partnerships with young farmers, there is an opportunity for a new generation of farmers to, as Philip said, not go into debt. So there's a farmer land match program that is out there, and I'm going to be putting a link in the show notes for anyone listening to this. It is designed so that you have the generation that wants to put their property into easement and set up a little bit like what Philip is talking about there, setting it up for new farmers to come on board so that we can preserve these amazing treasures that are so critical to our food and to our quality of life and definitely to our cider and pore.
How many heads of cat, you know, cows do you have?
How many
cows?
45 cows.
Wow. And are
dairy
they
dairy cows?
They're dairy cows.
Yeah.
Right.
And 45 that we milk morning and evening. And so
you're busy.
Totally, we have 100 animals.
100 animals. You have the
every year, because
wow.
The heifers do their first baby at 3 years old. So every year we need to have between 12 and 15 replacer heifers, and some male sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's every year between 15 and 20 young.
Busy time in the spring, very busy.
All the year? But
yeah, all year, true.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so I see that's going down now, the pump's going down, and you just turn it off because right now it's like the lees on the bottom or the what we call the yeast, the pumped out pore, the yeast is on the bottom. You can see that this is a milk tank that they leave open overnight, keeping it down to temperature that first night, and then it pumps into the container in this back room. And just so you could kind of see the whole piece here, that's like the scratcher right in front of me. And that normally isn't here, but it's all open air. Probably some of us are just licking our chops saying, geez, I wish we could keep it so simple. It's a certain beauty to the simplicity. This big wall separates from the pressing room.
And all the sediment we grow in the tank.
Coming right out, yep. Oh, it's going to go into the tank.
Another one.
Oh, yeah, okay. Another one.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's spraying the milk tank right now, cleaning it all up. Actually, really easy clean job. Just gets sprayed right out. Don't have to like do much more cleaning than that. I see a little white brush here, but that's about it. I just, the beauty of the simplicity is just part of the drink here. It just makes it so simple. So there's a little hose on top of the filter, and it's doing a little separation, trying to figure that out. I'm wondering, so this pipe here that goes on top of that filter, that's coming from... That's just...
Straight away after the press.
Right after the press, and you pour it on there. I see, to filter out, yeah. They have a little screen on top of the milk tank. So from the press, he's pressing the juice, it goes through the screen, and he just slammed it into the bucket of the backhoe, and it'll go and be composted and feed the cows eventually. So now he's just spraying it down because that's what you do. You just rinse with water, right? That's all you're doing.
Yeah.
You're cleaning just water from the well.
Yeah.
Because I also, you know, I have wooden baskets and I have a little bit of black, so I, you know, cleaned it up and scrubbed it. But, you know, some people say, why are you doing that? But I'm like, I did all wild yeast. Same, just like you're doing it.
Yeah. What you should avoid is the beginning of transformation alcohol in vinegar.
Right.
That affects more because lactic bacteria.
The lactic bacteria.
Are not good for cider and porree, but the rest is.
You make the porree and one type of cider, or are you doing one type of porree, one type of cider?
Sometimes two types of cider.
Two
types of porree as well. One more sweet.
One more sweet.
Porree d'enfant. And more bit normal and medium, and two cider, one the same, one more sweet, and because people sometimes want to choose, and several sort of juice, apple juice, and two or three sort of pear juice. It depends of the variety
the variety,
we've got.
Yeah.
So it's not the same every year.
Right, of course.
We taste and say, that would be good. So what we do yesterday.
And then you do an aperitif.
Aperitif, we mix. We blend
pear juice and
calvados, apple juice and calvados.
Mm-hmm. And then you do the calvados, which is...
And vinegar.
Okay, vinegar. The calvados, what percent porree versus cider is in this? And is that...
Difficult to appreciate, but 70% of porree in the calvados.
Okay.
And in this part of Normandy, if you are in the north of Normandy, it's 100% apple.
The standard is 70%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Originally, the plan was that we would just meet in the morning and then I would be on my way. But Philip invited me to return from my errand and watch as he was pressing pears to make porree that then would be distilled into calvados. Typically, if he was making a porree, he would allow the pears after they were crushed to sit out for perhaps 24 hours in what is called maceration. There's contact with oxygen, the pears brown, and it is for the purpose of breaking down the pulp and also really enriching the tannins and the sugars. But for calvados, they don't allow the pears to go through that maceration. They just crush, press, put it in that little milk tank, and then pump it up into the next tank to ferment. And later on, it would be distilled into calvados. So that's what I did. And then eventually, it was time to sit down and have a sip of his product.
Now, is this your sweeter one?
No, it's a drier.
The dry one, okay. The residual sweetness, it just blows me away. I mean,
What did you say? The residual?
The residual, the...
Sugar?
Yeah, the sugar, yeah. I mean, it's just amazing the amount of... yesterday I was in the field and I bit into a pear and I just couldn't believe the amount of juice, and it was a peri.
Mm-hmm. Polar pear. And that's incredible. Look at the bubbles. Are you... Yeah. You're adding a little bit of...
Never.
Not sugar, but pear juice. Nothing.
No yeast. I don't want...
So you...
I am not enough technical to play with
that. Yeah, wow.
I prefer... Sometimes it can be a bit nervous. It's happened. Mm.
The poré is each place I go to is a little bit different.
Yeah, because the ground is different.
A beautiful label.
It's a draw.
I could tell it is. Yeah, and there is the gage.
The gadage, oui.
Uh-huh. Oui, yeah, and just palm and poré. So 4%. Tiny little bubbles, all bottle conditioned, corked. This is from last year.
Yeah.
Last year, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Right, 1 year old.
1 year old.
It has been bottled in March.
Yeah.
After a wee bit of poré, which I will say was indeed delicious, no doubt I have an empty bottle sitting in front of me with this lovely label. Let me just describe that for you. It says poré fermé, which means Perry Farmer. And it's a very simple label, but the simplicity is what's so beautiful here. You can see the degage, which is that large circular concrete base on the ground, which would be used to throw the apples in, and then a large round concrete like stone, typically maybe a stone or something from Germany or something would come over, and they'd roll that around in a circle, often being turned by a horse. And then it has a little bit of a semblance of the courtyard. Really sweet, and such a purity of this farm. Really speaks volumes of the farmers there. Anyways, Philip and I took a walk about. We went behind where the cows were kept, and there I saw, held up along the barn, all these pears.
18, how do you call it? Eatable pears? 18 pears?
18 varieties of
18
pears.
Varieties, yeah.
Right winter, along the...
Winter varieties.
Wow.
Normally we take them, put in a box, and eat in February.
And store them. Wow.
Yeah.
That's super cool. Right there. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Merci.
Conference. The name is very...
Nice. Looks very good. Ready to eat, too, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Every day.
Mm.
Every...
Wow.
Mm. C'est bon, hein?
Très bon. Mm. Really yummy. Looks a little bit like a Bartlett, but
it's
softer.
It's a privilege. To live in the country and
have
fresh food.
It is. So this is one of the orchards that we're walking up into. These trees, how old would you say they are?
So this one, this row are from 92.
Hmm.
We graft in 92. So 25 years old.
So did you have a rootstock and then grafted onto the rootstock, or?
I buy, we call it support of graft. They are
mm-hmm.
as big as that.
Mm-hmm.
And we graft at two mm-hmm. meters.
Mm-hmm.
We graft the... And the support of graft is... That is one who hasn't been graft.
Yeah, I'm not seeing a graft line.
Because they grow very quick. That's why the tree grower use this variety.
Mm-hmm.
It's a variety from Domfront. Very famous, very solid. So we cut and we graft what we want.
What is the variety?
So that is 25. This one is my age, 55. I remember my father telling me that they are small.
Nice.
These three. That is 100, 150, 200.
That's beautiful.
We don't know.
Wow.
And the smaller are thin.
The smaller ones back there, yep. I see, yeah, in the background, yep.
With the protection.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is a beautiful tree.
Now, how do you just
can
wait
you
for
imagine,
the...
Can you imagine, sorry, I cut you.
No, go
in
ahead.
Festival, they make a platform.
Oh, and there I were saw three... that. Yes, I did, and they're playing
it
the instruments.
It was pouring, raining, because 2 years ago, it has rained. The day before the festival, it has been 2 months without raining, February, March and April. Mm. And the day before the festival, it started to rain 4 days following.
Mm.
70 millimeters, 3 inches of water in 4 days.
Oh, bummer.
And 2,000 person came anyway.
Wow.
With boots and...
Why not?
You can see if you see the first video, people are smiling.
I saw that. I saw it, and I saw the rain too, and I saw them up in the tree in a hammock, and I was like, "What is that song?" I wanted to hear the whole song, and so that happens in
the first was in 2015, and the second.
But what month?
April. First April. May. 1, 2, 3, or 29 April.
So it's 30, the end of April and beginning of May. Mm. Yeah.
And this one, we had 1 day of sun.
Oh, <On three. laughs> boy. Oh, boy. That happens, though, doesn't it? That's so, part of it.
Sorry, you wanted to say something to me?
I was wondering, you said that this tree
hasn't
is
been
a
graft?
No, it's a classic pear
variety.
Tree. What's a variety?
We call it poire de Domfront.
Poire de Fond. Domfront. Okay, yeah. So
Longuet. Yeah. Okay. Every one has a... That is champagne.
Champagne.
Champagne,
okay.
That Pomera... Different names.
Yeah, they all have amazing names. And how about this 100-year-old?
Beauvais, celui-là.
Beauvais. And I was also asking you, you wait for the pears to drop?
Yes.
And then you come with like a
machine.
Machine that
now we don't do by hand. Some did by hand, but it's too much work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
So some variety you need to pass twice a week. Certain you can be 10 days.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
You have to know.
Yeah.
So that's 1 hectare of orchard, and we have about six hectares. Half is apple trees and half pear trees.
And is that up over the hill here?
Yeah, it's apple over there.
Okay, yeah. All right. Wow.
We try to not to mix.
Right.
Apple and pear trees. It's for the organization of the work. It's easy when you have
keep it
the
separate.
Same fruit at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, this one are very late, so they are independent in this field because you can't. The animal can't go when the pear are falling during 1.5 months.
Right. Right.
They eat the grass after. But the fact there is trees. That's it's a very. The place very wet. When I was young, that was a place for washing the
clothes. Wow.
Right here, by hand.
Wow.
So the fact.
Wow, that drainage area.
That has drained.
Wow, no kidding. So was this your family's home then?
My family's farm.
Family's farm.
And my father has been a tenant. This orchard is a poultry for.
Calvados?
Apple juice and some are for eaten.
Right.
You say eaten apple or?
I would say, eating apple or culinary. Culinary because you cook with it, you don't drink it.
You say culinary?
Culinary, yeah.
I never heard that word.
Yeah. It's But eating apples are fine.
You don't say edible.
No. Edible? You could be an edible. It would
you
be.
You say there is a incredible edible in there.
Yeah, edible would be kind of.
Vegetable and everything.
More than you need to say. It's like a. It sounds almost clinical a little bit, an edible apple. We say an eating apple or culinary apple or dessert apple.
Okay,
and then people break down pears that way too. Culinary pears or eating pears, and then they say cooking pears that you don't eat with. So too much.
So
this
part of the orchard is for eating.
Yeah, and you have it protected from the cows.
Yeah, because they eat the tree.
They eat the tree. They don't do that with the pears.
No, only the apple. Also, we protect the pear trees when they are young because they will scratch on it and
break it.
So, but when they are big, the pear trees, they don't touch it.
Yeah, they like
the
that.
Apple trees, sometimes they eat the bark.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course. Philip and Mary Claire are one of 14 farms that produce poré. They are part of the Route du Poré in that region of southern Normandy. And each of these sites are working farms. So it's a full cycle. You're going to see the cows, and you're going to see the trees, and you're going to see very, very busy people. Every other year, starting in 2015, then in 2017, and the next one should be in 2019, Philip and Mère Claire open up their farm to artists and musicians for what is called in English, the call to wood, and in French, l'appel au bois. Having walked around the farm and seen some of the setup, it was a little reminiscent of Bread and Puppet up in Glover, Vermont, and a wee bit of the Oregon Country Fair out by Eugene, Oregon. So keep that on your list if you happen to make it to this region of France in the springtime in 2019. And before we totally say goodbye to this region, I'd like to say something that I found out about, which I thought you might find very interesting, in that in the 11th century, when cider apples were being introduced to France from northern Spain, pear trees were already growing in the region. So we're talking about ancient varieties. And one of the key varieties used in all the poré in that region is called Plant du Blanc. 40% of the juice for poré must come from this particular pear. If you want to see a list of other pears used in the poré for that region, go to episode 123, The Pear Farmer in Loire, France. When this podcast goes live on April 11th, we're going to be short of 20 days till the end of April. And at the end of April, well, the early cider bird special for the Totally Cider Tour to Normandy is going to end. And that means, well, let me back you up a little bit. That means that I've set up a tour. We're going to be stopping to see Philip. Last week's episode 122 was with Michel D'Argent, and I featured a secret cider maker there. We're going to be both in the Domfront region and initially up in Pédoge region, which is in northern Normandy, and visiting cider makers there. We're going to have a number of cider dinners. See Mont Saint-Michel, which is one of those UNESCO historical, unbelievable sites. I mean, Mont Saint-Michel has this kind of epic history. It was actually kind of overtaken by the Vikings for a while. There were Druids out there. Then the Catholics came in. Then it was made into a prison. And only recently was it actually opened to tourists. So we're going to be having a cider dinner with a beautiful, spectacular view. Fingers crossed for perfect weather, of course. But you know, my experience in Normandy, every day, even a rainy day, was beautiful, especially in that time of year when the pears and the apples are abounding on every tree possible. And you just kind of reach up, pluck a little piece of paradise, and get to sink your teeth and your taste buds into the exquisite tannins and terroir of that region. Talk about upping your cider game. If you want to get in on this, I really recommend you do, because people are signing up. I expect this to sell out. Now would be the time to do it, because now, between now and the end of April, all that's required is a deposit. After April, it's going to be a different story. And so it becomes, you know, a little bit more to kind of focus on. So let's bring it home and head out to Normandy with some amazing people on the trip that I've already signed up. And I hope that one of them will be you. If you want any more info, just shoot me a line, Rhea@ciderchat.com. Or you could go to the Cider Chat page called Totally Cider, or Google totallycider.com. You'll see all the info, what it includes, and get the reservation form right there. Just fill it in. It's all online, super duper easy. Take time today to discover a hidden apple or pear tree out in the forest or woodland area. Look for those blossoms blazing in the sunlight. Now is the time. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville. Yeehaw!